The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
There are some handouts that are hopefully making their way around the big room. This is in addition to what you see in your notebooks. You should all be taking a look at an article, a magazine article that looks like this, and it's in the handout. And maybe if we can get a couple of other designees to help disseminate these, that would be wonderful. Apologize for the tardiness of the handout. I thought they were going to be here when you arrived. So as you're arriving, as you settle in, please take a moment to read this Time Magazine article from 1942. Under the heading Wartime Living. It's a classroom handout. We're in class now. So make like a student and read. Again, as you arrive, please get your hands on the handout, just a one-page magazine article. Well, good morning. My name is Chris Schlecks. I am a fellow of history at New St. Andrews College. And when I talk about teaching, most of my illustrations are probably drawn from history examples. But what I'm having you do is something that I just might have students do, to hand them something at the very beginning. And what I might do then is divide the class into small groups. Now, this is a pretty large class here, but what I might do is divide you into groups of three or four, and I would put this up on the front here. I'd have this PowerPoint. According to the article, what role should blank play in the war effort? Okay, this group over here, and I'm waving in my hypothetical gesture, this group over here, fashion designers. You are going to discuss what role fashion designers play in the war effort. And then there's another group. What role does the national media play in the war effort? That's going to be Group B. Group C, or local media. Group D, leading women. What role do leading women play in the war effort? The United States government. What role do they play in the war effort? And everyday women consumers and so on. So I've got groups A, B, C, D, E, and F. And then the class would gather, they would confer, they would buzz with one another, whatever you want to call it, for about 5 minutes, determine what their answers would be. Then we would come back to the class as a whole, and I would have a designee from Group A address the question, what role do fashion designers play in the war effort? Now, does anybody want to answer the question, what role fashion designers play in the war effort? This is a real solicitation of a real answer from me to you. Yes, it is. Stand up, please. And can you maybe project so that they can hear? How is designing uniforms? So she says design uniforms. How is that going to translate into victory over Hitler? Design, connect the dots. Designing uniforms, victory over Hitler. There's some intermediate steps I'd like you to cover. Could you do? I bet you can, though. Please do. Okay. All right. So she says, when you look good, you perform better and you're more confident. Is that what the article says that the role that fashion designers have in the war effort? You look good, and Hitler doesn't like it when the Allies look good. Okay, that wasn't it. Anyone else want to take a crack at it? Tell me how you get from fashion design to defeating Hitler. Here, I'm going to help you with the...
They are to redesign the clothes and repurpose them so that more funding can go to the war effort. More funding going to things such as providing for the troops, bullets, guns, artillery, et cetera, defeat Hitler.
Okay, so you say this is about funding. Where does this funding come from? Like, does this have to do with government spending too much money on fashion and government actually needs to make armaments? Is that what you mean by repurposing funding?
No.
Okay, what do you mean then? Get me from fashion design to beating Hitler. Yep, you said funding.
Yeah.
I think you're on to something.
So, I agree. I've missed a couple dots there.
Okay.
So, part of it is saving at home. I know that part of that is...
Is it money that we're saving?
Cloth is part of it too, yes.
Okay, yeah. We're saving cloth. Why would we want to save cloth? How is that going to help us defeat Hitler?
It would provide clothing for the blankets, for the uniforms for soldiers.
Okay.
Because Europe can be cold in the wintertime.
Okay.
So.
Okay, very good. So we've got supplying the troops. You're doing a great job. Supplying the troops. Now, how are we? Do we get from fashion design to saving cloth that can be accessible to the troops? I like your saving cloth, right? So you connected saving cloth to defeating Hitler. We need to get to fashion design to saving cloth. So we've got another dot to connect here. Okay, go ahead.
No more wonderful, voluminous skirts. They're going to be straight now. And belts are going to be thin.
Okay, how is that going to save cloth?
Straight skirts don't require as much cloth as voluminous skirts.
Okay, sure. All right, very good. Now, some of you who maybe have studied World War II, we had the idea of the victory suit as opposed to a zoot suit. A victory suit, of course, is a suit in during wartime. Going into wartime, you would have the men's three-piece suit. The conventional suit would have pleats. That's too much fabric, though. Victory suit has no pleats. Victory suit has no cuffs. It definitely does not have that unnecessary vest. You take away the vest, so you've got a two-piece suit. The lapels are going to go narrower. I'm talking about men's fashion here, of course. The lapels are going to go narrow, and the waistline is going to climb. Anything to save cloth. But with this article now, we've got women's fashion design. There's something about latest fashions, and the article mentions that we need to convince women that this year's fashions really haven't changed since last year. Okay, and I think you can see how that's going to save fabric here. All right. And we would go around. There's one group gives their answer, another group gives their answer, and so forth. Another follow-up question I might ask for each of you who answer is, where is that in the article? Where is that in the article? You've made that connection. Where is that in the article? Is it explicit or is it assumed? Is it explicit or is it assumed? But I'd like to begin a class this way. In fact, I might have described 15 or 20 minutes, maybe even 30 or 40 minutes of a class discussion. Now, we might proceed with this discussion, turn it into a group discussion here. This could turn into, I'm thinking maybe in a 50-minute class period, maybe in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I might throw something like this up here. And I'd say, take out a sheet of paper, last 10 minutes of class. Take out a sheet of paper, and every student individually will craft their answer to this question. Agree or disagree, World War II was fought in the Pacific, the Atlantic, Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa, but not in North America. Agree or disagree and explain your answer. And then the students would write their for 5 or 10 minutes on this. You can do this in maybe half a page, 5 or 10 minutes, just to spit it out, get their thoughts out. As we have the discussion, anticipating that this question is coming up, I might have fleshed out some of the premises for this. Or here's another one. Agree or disagree, the important players in World War II were the politicians, military leaders, and soldiers. Do you agree or disagree? Interesting lesson. I think we'll probably get some different answers for this. Here's another one. The consequence of World War II for women is this. Because the war effort pushed so many American women into the workforce, women came to be viewed as no different than men. It's a common trope of World War II about gender change, that women became like men in World War II. Does this article reinforce the idea that women are becoming like men, or does this article actually reinforce that women are women and men are men in the war effort? Maybe we're even challenging a commonly held trope of World War II on issues of gender. Anyway, these are just options that I, the teacher, came up with that I might just throw up on the board and write on this. Now, what I might do after class, at the end of the day, is I've got these responses. What I might do with the students, or what I might do is I'd sift through them. I can check students are paying attention, that kind of thing. I might read them. I might buzz through them quickly. I might actually, as a teacher, take 10 minutes to go through the entire stack. I'm just buzzing through. The students just prepare these in the last 5 or 10 minutes of class, right? So I'm going through, and I might select 3 or 4 to open the next class period with. I'd like Jane to read hers. I'd like John to read his, and Jane and John don't agree with one another, or they've got different points of emphasis or whatever. So all that to say, I'm describing the construction of a lesson. Describing the construction of a lesson. This is about good lessons versus bad lessons. And I'm going to be drawing upon this illustration as of a lesson to kind of describe what teachers
do well, what teachers can do poorly, and I hope this lesson, this little mock lesson, will dig into some of that. And I hope, and of course, we are interested in teachers teaching well. And so what I want to cover basically is good versus bad preparation and planning on the one hand, and lesson delivery on the other. You can see that this is the pattern of the outline. What this really gets at on the planning end is lesson construction away from the presence of the students, and then delivery lessons when you're in the presence of the students. And I would submit to you that students or teachers need to be very intentional about how we spend our time when we are not in the presence of students. Now, I'm always sought for athletic analogies. I play soccer. If you have a goal-oriented sport like soccer or basketball, one of the things that's very important, the difference between a good soccer player and a bad soccer player, has to do with whether he knows what to do when the ball is not at his own feet. So it is with teaching. The teachers know what to do when you're actually not in that contact moment. We need to be intentional about our preparation. We need to be intentional about our preparation. My design here, I have new young teachers in mind, seasoned, experienced teachers. I think preparation sort of, they have their rhythms and routines. But I think that those rhythms and routines from seasoned teachers sometimes need to be trued up. I also have administrators in mind as you think about how you might want to be mentoring new faculty as I talk about this. What sort of things would you talk about when you've got somebody who's fresh and green out of college and has not really spent much time with junior high kids in their recent life? And what are you as an administrator going to offer them? So it's you that I kind of have in mind when I walk through this. Some of this is going to be, this is the football level stuff. So much of it I think is commonsensical that I'm going to relate to you. But it's interesting, when you get in the heat of battle, so to speak, of teaching, and the shots are whistling past your head, you forget common sense sometimes. Have a plan. Construct a good lesson. So, hopefully this will be helpful then, in that way, even the commonsensical part of it. So I'm going to talk first about planning, and then a few things about delivery as well. First of all, in planning or preparation, planning happens in three scales. You see I'm following the outline here, quarterly, weekly, and daily. And I want to work through each of these scales. You need to think in terms of the kind of planning you do four times a year, the kind of planning that you do, I don't know, maybe 32 or 35 weeks out of the year, and then the kind of planning you do every single day. And you should have different purposes and goals in view. And all three scales are important. In fact, one of the biggest issues with planning is that you're just feeling like you're a day ahead of the students and you neglect the quarterly aspect of planning or the weekly aspect of planning and you wind up doomed and you lose the forest for the trees in how you're approaching your classroom life. The quarterly and weekly planning is very important. So I'm going to take up quarterly first, and my voice is going to crack as I do apparently. But this is sometimes best undertaken in the summer. In the summer, you have the luxury of surveying the whole course, don't you? So in quarterly planning, you should create benchmarks that are weekly, sort of goals. Okay, I've got a 10-week quarter or an 8-week quarter, whatever your school calendar is. By week one, I want to be here. Week two here. Week three there. Just kind of getting... And we're working through a text. We've got some readings. We're a literature class, and we're going to go through Hamlet. Okay, Hamlet's how many acts? How many days on Act 1? How many days on Act 2? And kind of have that so that you will know you've got the whole quarter at a glance or year at a glance. You're creating those benchmarks that are going to be really critical when you're doing your weekly and daily planning. You can know, am I ahead or behind? Things like that, critical. And then the second point should be submitted to the administrator who is accountable for the implementation of the curriculum. And sometimes this quarterly planning is a wonderful
opportunity to sit down with the administrator. Administrators, you might want to think about having quarterly meetings with faculty, and this would be one of the routine agenda items in your quarterly meeting with each faculty member. Let's see your quarterly plan. I want to see it. It is so helpful as a teacher to know that the principal is going to see this. The simple fact of handing, and even if the administrator doesn't read it, if the administrator projects the illusion that he will, is really beneficial for me. So I strongly urge you, make this a requirement. Remember that your teachers are human beings. Part of this is preserving the humanity. Teachers are not as high and mighty as we might think we are. We have ordinary lives and we have our own foibles and this, and accountability and routines. Why do we have assignments and grades for our students? Because they're human. And we all need that, don't we? We all need the accountability. All right. Weekly planning. Once a week, set aside a time once a week, and it should be part of your rhythm. Maybe for you it's going to be every Thursday afternoon. Maybe for you it's going to be every Monday. I don't know when it's going to be. But what you're going to do is you're going to survey the entire week, and you're going to plan the entire week ahead. And this is when you're going to consult that. You're going to break out that quarterly plan, the benchmarks, and you're going to assess, how am I doing here? This is your weekly planning. And you're figuring out what assignments are going to be asked, but am I making progress? Am I going through the information? Am I meeting curricular objectives? What are the curricular objectives for this course anyway? What am I being held accountable to? I only gave one assignment last week. Maybe I need to give a couple more assignments because the grade book's looking pretty thin. All right. And so assess the past week, prepare memos to self for next year weekly. That's really, how did the last week go? And, boy, you will be your biggest fan next year. I do this on my notes a lot. I make notes to self. I've got computer files with this handout, that handout, and I will just create a text box superimposed on the worksheet, and I'll type, question 3, students didn't get it, rewrite it. I don't have time to rewrite question 3 now. But I'll just say, rewrite question 3. Save, move on. I put that worksheet away till next year, because next year I will have forgotten that question 3 is not clearly worded. Or maybe if it's quick enough, I'll just reword it right then for next year on this worksheet. But I'm doing an assessment of how the last week went, what went, and I'm writing notes to myself, and those notes to myself from last year, I really like getting mail for myself. That's very important. And then, of course, next week lessons, and then submitted to the administrator. Weekly lesson plans should be submitted to the administrator. If it's a new teacher, a first-year teacher, maybe you might even want to have a weekly interaction with or every other week or something like that, just to see how things are going, to mentor or shepherd the student through. Maybe there's a senior teacher who can meet weekly with the new teacher with weekly mentoring. So submit to the mentor teacher, however it works. And then daily planning, keep at least a day ahead. You should have all of tomorrow's worksheets prepared today. You should have them run off today. And the sorts of things that, like in that lesson that I implemented, the questions that I had sorted out for that article, I think I would have selected that article in weekly planning, but it would be in daily planning where I'd look at it and say, okay, what am I going to actually do with this article? A bad daily lesson plan would be, we're going to read the article as a class. Horrible daily lesson plan. The day before, I'm thinking, okay, I'm looking through it, I need to give some handles on it, and that's when I crafted those questions, thought about it, we'll divide into small groups. So I thought that up. I've already, the actual implementation and mechanics of what that's going to look like. And you revise them every day. Sometimes something happens today, and so today's lesson plan kind of continues tomorrow and you're always making adjustments in your daily plan. Maybe you're actually going to skip what you had originally planned on Thursday. That happens, but make those decisions intentionally and give yourself space to do that. Don't decide Thursday at the beginning of class that you're going to skip what you had planned Thursday for class. That's the bad time to decide to skip that. Wednesday was a much better time to decide to skip Thursday's originally planned lesson. And then, this is critical, give special attention to the first and last 5 minutes of class. The first and last 5 minutes of class. What are the students going to be doing initially, and what are the students going to be doing at the end? And I'm going to talk about this a little bit more in lesson delivery as well, but plan the first, these are the most important moments in the class, the first moments and the last moments. So more on that in lesson delivery. Oh, look at this. I've got this. Yes. And by the way, isn't technology wonderful? Look, there's red, and then the number two is red, and then number three is red. Do you see how the daily circles and the weekly circles do? That's just awesome. All right. So, the allocation of the teacher's time in a work week. This is, I've taught interactive with high school students for about 30 years now, and I've done a lot of teacher training, interacted with a lot of other teachers and a lot of other schools. And especially for new teachers, I mean, experienced teachers have their routines worked out, but I think new teachers often ask me, how long should I be spending on this, that, the other, and time allocation? Administrators, this is also very important. In your assignment of workloads, are you carving out time in your teacher's day for them to plan? And so this is just my sort of, this will vary from person to person, but I'm just saying it here. Contact time, you're actually with students about 25 hours a week. Elementary teacher, you know, maybe it's going to start at 8:30, go till 3, and with a lunch break or something like that, and maybe you've got a prep period while the kids are off to music, things like that. And high school teachers are not going to necessarily have every period. So it's about 25 hours of contact time a week. And then you've got, but I'd like you to realize that contact time, that's about half the time of being a teacher. About half the time of being a teacher. And that contact time goes well when you spend the time that's not contact time well. That comes back to my point about how important planning is. You reap the benefits in contact time for well-spent time when you're not having the contact time. So for new teachers, 10 hours a week planning. You've got maybe 10 hours, and then grading, maybe 10 hours. That can be daily. There can be weekly. Meetings and administration, there's always staff faculty meetings. Don't overburden your teachers with meetings. And then study time, teachers must be students. And this is precious, and not too many people do this. You get so immersed in the business of the day that you're not reading that book that you should be reading that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with today's lesson plan or tomorrow's lesson plan. Now, I think the difference really between the experienced teacher and the new teacher is that some of that planning time can act for the experienced teacher can be saved and study time increases. So if you've taught the same material for 10 years, you probably have the luxury of a little bit more time in studying. So I just throw some of the planning over to the study time, the more experience you get. Understanding objectives. This is very important. Objectives. A good lesson plan, and I would say this is in the weekly lesson plan, an objective is expressed in terms of what the student is doing, not what the teacher is doing. It is not a good objective to say, discuss the causes of World War I. What needs to happen in order for that objective to be met? Well, the causes of need of World War I need to be apparently verbalized by somebody in the room. Objective met. It needs to be written in terms of student performance, not teacher performance. Let's see. Let me comment on this. When I started teaching, one of the best things that happened in my teaching experience is that the principal came in and observed me and gave me an evaluation that had, and this was the first sentence on the eval, this was about 25 years ago. This lesson was unsatisfactory. Unsatisfactory. And I thought it was great. I knew that the principal was going to be sitting in my class the next day, and I'm really into church history, and I still remember the lesson. I was talking about Pope Boniface VIII and the Babylonian captivity and great schism. Really, you know, church history in the 1300s and really juicy stuff. This was fantastic. And I organized it all, and I was going to make all these points, and I made all these points. I wrote them all up on the board, and I had all these, and I went through it in an orderly sequence. Everything came off well. And then at the end of the day, there's the memo in my box to meet with the principal, and it was a page of notes. But that first line was, this lesson was unsatisfactory. Best thing that ever happened to me as a teacher. You know what happened? The principal had this crazy idea that teaching is about what the students do. And he spent his entire time watching the students. I was conceiving of teaching as an activity that I do. I was conceiving of teaching as an activity that I do, and preparing, and preparation is me learning. And what actually was happening in that classroom was a dispensing of what I had learned, not what the kids were doing. The kids were respectful, they were attentive, they were quiet. It was a good class, it was a good school culture. It was Logos School in Moscow. One of the things that makes Logos School great is Logos School is the kind of school that gives evaluations like that to teachers. That's why my kids are still in Logos School, because Logos School has standards to give teachers like me and lessons like that unsatisfactory assessments. We need to have a Copernican revolution. If the students aren't embracing it, if the students aren't getting it, if the students then aren't doing something, then learning hasn't happened. The purpose of teaching is to evoke learning in somebody else in the room, rather than to act and act and act and do, do, do. If you think of teaching in terms of what you do as a teacher, then get out of the business. Students must not be inert. Learning is not happening if students aren't doing the learning. The job of a teacher is to create the circumstances, the opportunities, the desires, the conditions where that is going to happen. And it's fundamental at the level of an objective. And so if you look on the back of the handout, I've given you... This is the planning side of what I've given you here. So I've got a content. This is the daily planning content objective. SWBAT. Student will be able to explain the historical significance of the home front in World War II. And I put that in all my objectives. SWBAT. Student will be able to. It's in terms of what the student can do. If it's written or expressed in terms of what a teacher will do, Schlecht will discuss the historical significance of the home front in World War II, then that objective can be met by the students doing nothing. You see that? The students can do nothing, and yet that objective can be met. So frame it in terms of student, not teacher activity. So I've got a content objective, and then because I'm a history nerd, I like to get history skills in. The students will be able to justify historical claims from historical sources, recognize historical agency in a wide variety of actors. And I have that in mind, historical agency, the agency of different actors. And so, and you saw that reflected hopefully in some of the questions that I asked. Then I prepared activity, read, discuss the article, last 5 minutes. Students ran on this prompt, and I've got several possibilities.
Look, I've got different prompts, I think, than some of the ones that I wrote. Then I've got my own little crib notes for discussion. WPD shows up in the article. By the way, you might have noticed in the Word Production Board was mentioned in the article. I would still have the students read it without explaining the Word Production Board to them. They would read the article, and in the process of discussing, hopefully, the curiosity will be aroused of what the Word Production Board is. And I will, and this is because sometimes I'm short of memory. This is one of the things I have at my lectern, like, oh, be sure and cover this thing. This is a point of information to help them understand the article. And I've got this as notes to self. And then possible seat work questions. Oh, look at letter B here, teacher's crib notes. A female hat, 70 female hats assembled. I'm prompting myself, catch that. What rhetorical device is that? 70 female hats. And because I can be sometimes dim or forgetful myself, there's a note to myself for the lectern. Oh, it's synecdoche. So I'm showing you the odds behind the curtain here on the back side of the handout. Students get the handout, not this. This is the odds behind the curtain here. Okay, and this is a reflection of daily planning. The seat work questions are there. Notice I've got actually different seat work questions laid out. But you see, that's how lesson planning proceeds. Okay, so they need to be written in a way that can be assessed. Did the students actually do it? Okay, can the students explain something particular? And is there a method by which I can assess that? In this lesson, the last 5 minutes, that writing exercise at the end, I can also assess it just by listening to their responses verbally. That's a form of assessment. And poor objectives, common mistakes, I think I've already addressed this, but the work, well, I don't have a slide for this, but the worst kind of objectives are the ones that simply say, we will cover this content. That's not an objective. Okay. Discuss the cause of World War II. Okay, who's going to be discussing? You want to elaborate on that? Student activity, student activity, student activity. All right. Common signs of bad planning. You plan badly if. Let's see. So it gets a May, and you find yourself rushing through material because, boy, we need to cover all this material, and I'm behind. If you discover in May that you're behind, then that is a sign of bad quarterly and weekly planning. Maybe you had a good quarterly plan, but you never consulted it. And you never made, it's one thing to fall behind, but then once you do fall behind, you have to make decisions. It always happens. I'm always falling behind. I'm probably going to fall behind in this workshop. And then, unfortunately, I don't have the daily lesson plan to take a break and say, what am I going to have to make those decisions on the fly about what to cover and what not to. But sign of poor planning is you discover that you're behind in May. Not discovering that you're behind, that's just part of life. You might be behind, or maybe you can get ahead, or where can I save ground, or where can I prioritize it. Those kind of constant, ongoing assessments part of teaching. You plan poorly if you pile on assignments in the last week of the quarter in order to get something in the grade book. Again, bad weekly and quarterly planning. You know you plan poorly if the bell rings, or however your class period ends, the clock strikes, whatever it is, and you find yourself still in the middle of teaching new information or a new concept. And you just have to finish your sentence, and you let the kids go, so there it was. That's bad preparation, bad daily planning. And then it's also bad if you, the teacher, are the one who's doing all the work, and the inert students sit there in the same manner that they watch television. They're just watching you as the flickering image on the screen rather than doing activity. That's also bad daily lesson planning. Which segues us into lesson implementation that I'd like to turn our attention
there. Oh, look at there.
I did have a slide on it. Common signs of poor planning. That's what I went through that, didn't I?
All right. So, back to our main heading. Let's get into lesson delivery. I wanted to talk about this the first and the last 5 minutes of class.
I alluded to this in lesson planning. But opening rituals are important. If you're an administrator, you must be there to, and you're going to do an observation, get there before the students arrive and watch the arrival and the routines and the rituals and what the students do. Is there a culture of students getting down to business and a warmth in the student-teacher interaction as it's happening? Rituals are great.
Opening in prayer, that's a ritual, and it collects everyone. Okay, we're going to open in prayer now. We're ready to do this. I've been in classrooms where this teacher actually spends 10 minutes in the transition from hallway to classroom trying to corral the students to get them all on the same page. Rituals and routines, liturgy, classroom liturgy is very important. Oftentimes, that's just an MO, but there should be certain things, cues, that everybody Pavlovianly respond to that says it's time to get down to work, and that's immediate and soon. And it works us through that transition from hallway to class business. Provide an orientation. What are we doing? And so I planned my lesson. I'm going to have this handout, and I had questions that were displayed up in front about the reading, and that's how the class began. And so students come, they shuffle in, they get the handout, they have to read that article, and that article takes, what, all of 4 minutes to read. But that's what we're going to do, and provide an orientation. Get them, and you can do that by verbalizing something, or you just launch immediately into an activity that you're going to explain. But by orientation, what you're doing is you're telling the students and cueing the students what they must be doing. Providing an orientation is not necessarily verbalizing students. The objectives for today are A, B, C, and D. When you walked in, I told you to read. Now, you know what you're supposed to be doing. There you go. Now, I do think that it's helpful to lay out and explain to the kids some sort of game plan for the class, some sort of game plan for the class as well. So, and you need to create a need to know in the first 5 minutes of class, and you need to think about this in your lesson design. What am I doing that's going to arouse the student's curiosity, that's going to arouse the student's sense of work and task fulfillment? One of the things that I would do oftentimes read this article, but the task was, you can read the article in a couple minutes. I tell them you're going to divide up and you're going to answer these questions. And I would tell them what all the questions are, and when they're dividing up, they know what their group is supposed to do. They know the purpose of their group and what the group's task is. And so then they'll look back at the article. This is interesting. They'll look back at the article with their question trained on fashion designers. What are fashion designers doing to beat Hitler? Okay. Then they're going to approach that article with an intentional reading when they're gathering as a group, right? What I would not do is say, gather in groups, read this article, and discuss it. Discuss what, teacher? Okay, it's an article about fashion guys. There's Neiman Marcus. I think I've heard of that.
But if I say your task, when you're going to read this article, you're going to go through it as a group now, and your task is to explain how fashion designers are going to beat Hitler. Oh, okay. Well, now I need you to roll up my sleeves, and we're working together. This is creating a need to know. It's creating. You can do it by. Usually by creating a task for them. It's going to arouse curiosity and interest and a sense of focus in what they're doing. It doesn't have to be some kind of inspirational thing. And then plan the last 5 minutes of class. No matter where you are in the lesson, no matter where you are in the content coverage, as a teacher, you need to be trained on that clock. And if there's 10 minutes till the period ends, you need to be thinking of an off-ramp, no matter where you are. You need to be thinking of an off-ramp. Suppose you only went through a quarter of the material you planned to go through. It happens to me all the time. Maybe it's even happening in this moment. I'm not going to say whether it is or not. I'll leave that as a mystery. But the last 10 minutes of class, you need to be thinking of an off-ramp because the lesson needs to be punctuated. The lesson needs to be punctuated, takeaway. So we have this, we have the individual discussions, and then we have the group discussion as the small groups report to the big group, and we're having a discussion about the home front and World War II and all this good stuff, right? And maybe this is rip-roaring good time, and students are getting into it, and I'm probably really getting into it. And then the bell rings. I blew it. If I've got, I'm going to take that last 5 minutes. Okay, everyone, I want you to take out a sheet of paper, and I'm going to have you individually put your thoughts down. Boy, the last, I am a big fan of the last five-minute essay. Write down a paragraph, like, and answer this one question. Or what was the most, what was the most brilliant and the most petty point that was raised in the discussion? That might be something that I would have them write down. What was the most brilliant point, and what was the most petty point raised in the discussion? Which would be a great lesson beginner for the next day, too. Again, I'm going through these things. All right, but I'm planning and being very deliberate and intentional about the last 5 minutes of class. And I'm not coming up with the essay questions right then and there on the spot. That was part of my daily lesson. I came up with those the previous day. And in fact, I went through and tweaked and edited those questions a number of times to make sure that they would be clear for the students, so this, you don't have to explain what the essay prompt is. So I thought of the essay prompt ahead of time, last 5 minutes of class. All right. So that's first and last 5 minutes. Where's my clicker here? And then, again, you need to ask yourself in lesson delivery, who is the most active? If you are the busiest person in the class, then the class is probably problematic. Some of the best run classes that I've done observations on are classes where the students are busy and the teacher spend half the time in his desk. You can tell by watching what the students are doing. You can tell by watching what the students are doing. Administrators, always assess your teachers by what the students are doing, not by what the teacher's doing. And of course, the teacher, once again, is at odds behind the curtain. The teacher is manipulating everything. What Dr. Morris said is absolutely right. The teacher is behind everything that's happening in the classroom, but when it's a well-run classroom, it's not docile, inert students and an active teacher. A good teacher makes active students. All right. Am I assigning busy work? Ask yourself this question. Busy work. What is busy work? It's work that that serves no apparent purpose other than really to get us through time, pass the time. No apparent purpose. It's unproductive labor and sweat. The contrast to busy work is worthwhile work. And worthwhile work is going to call upon the student to draw upon his personality, the creativity in order to make it his own, to put his own stamp on it. It's going to call upon the student to produce something, giving him that sense of satisfaction that says, I did that. I did something. I did that. And if the student's just sitting there listening to you talk, then the student doesn't have that sense of identity. They haven't expressed their personality. One of the wonders of teaching is the recognition that students are created in the image of God, and as God's image bearers, they are fundamentally sub-creators. Have they engaged in the task of sub-creation? Too many teachers think of teaching as what they do, and that they are the creator. Realizing that now, when you're working with test tubes, and when you're on the assembly line at Ford, yes, you are the creator, and this car is created. But when you're a teacher, you're dealing with image bearers of God, and so as a teacher, you're being very creative, but it's this weird thing where you're creating creators, right? Are you treating the kids like machines, or like the stuff in a test tube, where it's all what you do? Or are you teaching them? So, worthwhile work gives it their stamp of a personality. So busy work, teachers assign busy work. Why do we assign busy work? Because we need to get through material. Oh, I need to get through World War II. Here's an article on World War II, and here's a worksheet. There we go. Read the assignment, do the worksheet. Yeah, you just kind of micromanage it. We all hate that, don't we? Now, it's possible to have a good worksheet, but a lot of times, especially if it's just fact recall, it's pretty bad. Read the selection, write an essay, hand it in, repeat and rinse. Read the selection, write an essay, hand it in, repeat and rinse. Okay. And so, busy work can take a lot of shape. A remedy for busy work is, first of all, to recognize what it is. Take stock. Maybe have them form relationships on your faculty where you can sit on one of those classes and someone can say, hey, if I were a kid in your class, I would have felt micromanaged and a pawn in your chess game. That's what I would have felt like. Or I was a stage prop in your theater and you were the one on stage. Now, I agree with what Dr. Mulder said, that we need teachers on stage. But again, the students are not your props. The students are actors with you, and you're the lead on the stage, right? Okay. Let's see here. Lecture is usually for lesson delivery for reasons that I've explained. Now, I do most of my teaching at college level. I spend a lot of time in lecture. But especially if you're dealing with junior high kids, older kids, and you've got them 5 days a week, oh my goodness. One of the things about college age is, you know, you only have them for a day or two a week, and they're doing all kinds of activity outside of class. But if you've got students 5 days a week, lecture is usually the station you know, it's turned on to the Schlecht station, and the students are tuned in, and they're just passively listening in to my YouTube channel or something. They've got to be doing something. New teachers come out of college, and their most recent experience with education delivery is at college mode, and they will actually think that it makes sense to talk to junior high kids, and it's only their voice in class for 40 minutes. Those poor kids. No matter how interesting or fascinating you think you are, and I'm remembering myself in that inadequate lesson, that unsatisfactory lesson that I just described to you, very few teachers can teach effectively young people through lecture. And it comes back to, and I've given you all the reasons for that already when I was talking about objectives. But lecture, boy, it helps me to cover the material, to cover the info. Are we about info transfer, or are we making students into mature sub-creators? All right, class discussions. Now, I've seen class discussions that are actually transacted the way a cross-examining attorney in a trial treats a witness. Now, on the night of the 15th, you were not at the mini mart, were you?
No.
In fact, you were at home, weren't you? And you were at home from 6:30 to 7:15, isn't that right? And you weren't the only one at home, were you? In fact, there were three other people at home, weren't there? One of those people was your brother. Isn't that right? And your brother, you were in the living room. Now, do you notice that's cross-examining attorney? This is the form of a question. Everything that I'm presenting to you is grammatically in the form of a question, isn't it? But who's really doing the testifying in the trial in a good cross-examination? It's the attorney who is just simply treating the witness as the prop, right? I've sat in on many classes where teachers actually think that they're conducting a discussion because students are responding, and students, it's kind of like, have you ever read Plato's dialogue with Socrates where the interlocutor is saying, indeed, yes it is. You know, Socrates elocutes this big long thing. It is as you say. That is not discussion. That is not discussion. You need to have well-framed prompts to get their ideas out. You can tell when it's a bad discussion. There are a couple of ways that you can tell a bad discussion. One of the ways is if a student gives an answer that is only audible to, say, the teacher, not audible to the person five rows back. You know that rhetorical space? If you and I are having a conversation, how are you doing? You comfortable? You doing well? Okay, very good. Any of you heard what she said? It's not a class discussion if there's a context around her where she doesn't feel compelled to speak so that you over there can hear. And so when I'm sitting in on a class observing, and if I hear the students, and the students feel like it's a social situation where they don't need to project their voice so that others besides the teacher can hear, poor discussion. Does that make sense? Private conversation space. And make the students speak so that others can hear. Another sign of a bad discussion is if the only one reacting to what other students say is the teacher. If you offer a response that, well, the reason why we defeat Hitler for fashion is because we save money and we can spend it on tanks or something like that, then if I interact with that, and I'm the only one interacting with that, that's a problem. I should make other students interact with it. You train students then to listen to one another. I've seen so many class discussions where it becomes a collection of one-on-ones with the teacher rather than a discussion where teacher is one voice and the lead voice, the bull elk of the herd, but one voice in student-to-student interaction. It's a real discussion if you've got student-to-student engagement. But, of course, it's frustrating. The students don't say things as well as you can. Right? What are you after? Are you training students? Or are you just trying to get your point across? You actually need to rest with messily stated, unclearly punctuated points if you actually let students discuss. And it's going to take a while to get around to the right thing. And you're frustrated about that because you're just trying to drive forward, right? Well, a good teacher can drive it forward better, but you're training students rather than simply pulling the kids on to your micromanagement train. Okay? So, that's a word about discussions, which leaves me with 1 minute for questions. Are we about done? Is our time up? Any questions? Yes. Yeah, student activities, remedies for busy work. Student activities also recognize it for what it is. Another remedy for busy work is to create a collegiality among the faculty where you float your ideas for lessons and lesson ideas with one another. It's important for administrators, I think, to kind of create that sense of collegiality. There's another question over here. Yes. Well, as an administrator, I think you need to have half the time as planning. And so whatever your school format is, the expectation is half the teacher's time is planning, and whatever the nature of your contact time is, it should hopefully follow these kinds of principles here. But this, I think the principles work whether you got a 5-day-a-week, a 3-day-a-week structure, or even homeschooling or something like that. Well, if you have other questions, I'd be happy to entertain you. You can approach me afterwards. Thank you all very much. You're a good group.
Well, it depends on what you mean by Socratic method. There's so many different things, some of them brilliant, some of them weird or weak. Socratic method. I really like things to see interaction. Now, you can do that by being kind of a transfer, so a student gets a response, and I will take the student's response to frame the questions we want to see. So that's a form of student-student interaction where I agree. But I would actually avoid repeating the student's response. I would make the student I'm asking the second question, they should have heard, and if they should have heard the premise upon which my thought is coming from, and I would make the first student repeat the response that I would need to repeat for them. Don't admit wallflowers. We all have kind of our go-to students. We're always going to say something brilliant, you know, you learn. So pull out the wallflowers. And then that first, that last 5 years thing, actually there's two things about it. The small groups are, I think, very important tool. Class discussion, whole class discussion, I don't think it's nearly as effective as smaller groups. You can scale it down and bring it back together, and that's one thing, which is not necessarily a strategy. If you're going to have a class discussion, this would be fine. And sometimes a small group discussion can do that, where they know, oh, I'm letting others, I've already rehearsed it with these people, but I know that these people are in on it. So that's a small group discussion, I think, is really good. And then the last 5 minutes thing, where it's actually individual work. And you can make reference to the discussion itself. And if you have a habit of those kinds of things, it trains the student, then you can get a hint. I will disallow them. I'll go to them. I'll make them repeat them. Usually they speak quietly, too. And I'll say, Bob, back there in the class, you're back. Did you hear what you said? No, I didn't. Say it so they can listen here. And I train them, and they're not going to get away with it. I would never let them get away with it. And that gets trained out of them pretty early. It's critical in that transition, I think, from elementary to in the junior high and high school. Like 6th, 7th, 8th grade